So what I want to try to do is say a little bit about what these elections are about and what they're not about. And then once I do that, to try to explain, there's really two basic camps in Israel this time, explain what animates, and then try to say something, I think, about the takeaways from this particular election. I think most people who have been following the election recognize that this is not an issues-based election at all. Issues have really, for all intents and purposes, not been discussed. And since the two major contenders, which are Bibi Netanyahu and the Likud, and blue and white with Benny Gantz, really don't have that many differences between them, that only contributes to the fact that this is really not issues-based, but it's much more a referendum on Benjamin Netanyahu. People who think that he's done a good job and should continue, and people who think for an array of reasons that I'll describe in a moment or two, that it's time for a change. Went to an open house two nights ago at which Bogi Yaalon, who was one of the top four of the Blue and White Party, spoke, and a person who's a good friend, who actually has a Shalem relationship, was sitting in a row in front of me, and he turned around to me and he said, "This is the opportunity for me to decide if I want to vote for a prime minister who I think needs to go, or for a bunch of generals about whom I know absolutely nothing." And I think that actually kind of characterizes where people are. People have their opinions about Bibi after 10 years, but the people coming in to challenge him are basically still unknowns. And that's why this is really, in a sense, a referendum on Benjamin Netanyahu and nothing more, nothing less. Say something very quickly about the issues that are not on the table, having said that it's not an issues-based election, just to remind you of some of the issues that normally might come up in an election that are really, at this point, really not being made. One, of course, is the whole issue of peace with the Arabs. That's just not on the table at all. Nobody's discussing it, not even, by the way, Israel's left-wing parties. Labor hasn't discussed it. Even Meretz, the most left-wing sort of mainstream-ish party, hasn't mentioned it at all. And the only thing, the reason I point that out is because for those of you who live in the States, which is the vast majority of people on the call, there is, of course, in the States a significant percentage of the American Jewish community which speaks consistently about the need to end the occupation now, about the need to reach a deal with the Palestinians and so forth. In Israel, that is considered to be, by the vast, vast majority of people, simply unattainable at the present and probably at any point in the near or intermediate future. So those orientations are very different. I thought it was worth noting. One issue that is not on the table that some people have tried to get on the table is the issue of annexation. Israel's far right-wing parties, Bennett and others to the right of him, are talking very openly about the need to annex parts of the West Bank. Some of them would say all of the West Bank. And people on the other side, most importantly, an organization called Commanders for Israel's Security, which is run by one of the heroes of the 1973 Yom Kippur War, General Amnon Reshef, they've been trying very hard to get the issue of annexation on the public agenda for a different reason, which is that they think that annexation is very, very dangerous to Israel's democratic spirit, because it would make several million Palestinians on the West Bank either permanent non-citizens, which would constitute, as they put it, apartheid, or to make them citizens, in which case you would dramatically reduce the percentage of Israel's Jewish demographic majority. Reshef and his colleagues are also pointing out that annexation is probably unaffordable in the sense that in an already taxed, for example, healthcare system, to add 2.5 million people to those who are eligible for MRIs and CTs and surgeries and so on and so forth would really, they argue, I think quite correctly actually, overburden an already struggling healthcare system. So peace with the Arabs has not been on the table, and annexation, which the right wants to get on the table and the center wants to get on the table, neither side has been able to make it a real serious conversation. Just to add a little bit of humor, one issue that is a tiny bit on the table is the legalization of marijuana. Moshe Feiglin, who's the head of the Zehut party off to the far right, says that he will not sit in any government that does not commit itself to the legalization of marijuana. I guess depending on the outcome of the election, we may need that, so that may be actually a good thing. But in any event, that's obviously not a serious issue. There's really no major issues on the table. So since it's really a referendum about Netanyahu, what I want to do for a couple of minutes is to articulate what I think are the major reasons that people point to when they say that they want to support Netanyahu, and then the reasons that people point to when they say that it's time for a change. So the reasons for Netanyahu. Number one, security has basically been fine. Israel is not invulnerable, as we saw a couple of weeks ago with rockets towards Tel Aviv. But Israel has basically not been in any major conflagration. There haven't been a tremendous number of Israeli casualties. People feel that Israel's operations in Syria have shown that Israel has a very long military arm. And since Israelis typically vote security, security, security as the first three issues and then economy, find is that security-wise, Netanyahu seems in many people's minds to have done a good job. And if the fourth priority after the first three being security is economy, the economy on a macro level, at least, is doing very well. There's obviously poverty in Israel. There is, like in America, a huge gap between rich and poor, and probably a growing gap between rich and poor. There's a huge housing crisis for the middle class, young kids who are not able to afford housing. And I can tell you that when I talk to our own students, they all talk in terms of the number of months' salary that it takes to buy an apartment. It's a number that is very much on Israelis' minds. So the economy on a micro level may not be doing great for some people, but nonetheless, on a macro level, it is also doing fine. There's also a sense on the part of Israelis that Bibi has done a very good job in situating Israel internationally. Israel has obviously certain tensions, for example, with Putin, because of Russia's involvement in Syria, but Bibi has managed to make it very clear that there's certain red lines that Putin cannot cross without actually destroying his relationship with Putin, which actually seems to be warm. When Netanyahu went to India for a few days, I guess it was last year, people were surprised actually that the Prime Minister of India spent all 3 days by Bibi's side. That was not originally expected. They'd expected a couple of formal dinners, and then he would go meet with various people. But he has a good relationship with Modi. He has a decent relationship with China. And that's obviously important. He's trying to actually spread out his eggs, of course. Everybody here understands, and Bibi certainly understands, that the pendulum in American politics will swing. It may happen in 2 years, it may happen in 6 years, it may happen in 10 years, or beyond that, but the pendulum is going to swing, and there is going to come a day when the Democrats control the White House and Congress. And given where the Democratic Party in the minds of many Israelis who watch it seems to be going, there is some concern that when that happens, Israel can't have all of its foreign policy eggs in one basket. And that's why Bibi is reaching out to India, which has a billion citizens and has very close cooperation with Israel in terms of buying technology, to China, Russia, obviously. But of course, Bibi has also been exceptionally successful in navigating the whole Trump relationship, which is not easy and which is not navigated yet. He's done a very good job. And I think everybody's aware that he's gotten three big presents from Trump. One was ripping up the Iran deal, one was moving the embassy to Jerusalem, and one, which was much more recent, was recognizing Israel's permanent sovereignty over the Golan. So Israelis say security-wise, he's doing fine. International relations, he's doing better than fine. The economy is chugging along just well. And one thing that Americans are not, I think, as often aware of as Israelis are when they talk about Bibi, is that Bibi has given a tremendous amount of credit for keeping Israel out of war. For all that he's perceived in America very often by a lot of people as being a kind of a right-wingish hawk, Israelis are keenly aware that there are a number of wars, both with Gaza and with Syria, that he has avoided even in the last year. And just as recently as two or three months ago, right before elections were declared, some of you may recall that things were really, really, really tense with Gaza. And we had occasion at that point to have a few students over one night from Hebrew University, not from Shalem that particular night, all of whom are pretty far to the left. And this was before elections were called. And one of them said to me, you know, we were all talking on the way over here, and we realized that if there were elections tonight, we would have all voted Bibi. And I thought, wow, that's pretty strange. And then they explained their logic. They said that if it had been Lieberman or Bennett in charge, Israel would have gone to war with Hamas. And if it had been Avi Gabay, who's the head of the Labor Party, or Yair Lapid, who's a centrist but also seen as the left-wing bloc, at the head of Yesh Atid, they said if they had been the prime minister, Israel would have gone to war because they would have had to prove that they have what it takes to go to war. And so the only person in that cabinet meeting who didn't want to go to war and had nothing to prove to anybody is Bibi Netanyahu. So he's actually given some degree of credit for keeping Israel out of war. So security, international relations, economy, keeping Israel out of war, those are all the things that people say actually accrue to a pretty decent record. And that's why whatever else might be said is why they think that Netanyahu, Israel would be best served by having Netanyahu remain in place. If that's the case, and that sounds like a pretty strong case, then what are the reasons that people think it's time for Netanyahu to go? And I'll divide them into several basic categories, the first three of which are commonly discussed by everybody, and the last of which is commonly discussed by only me. But the first is the first three are what I would call racism, corruption, and attacks on democracy. And the last one is what I would call an issue of vision, but we'll come back to that in a little bit. Now, obviously, the racism, corruption, and attacks on democracy are highly contested accusations. Not everybody agrees with them, although a lot of people do. And that was the reason that many people greeted with a tremendous degree of excitement the idea of a centrist party run by three former chiefs of staff of the Israeli army, and Yair Lapid, who's also seen as being a centrist, coming together to create the Blue and White Party. So again, to do each of these bullet points relatively quickly, I think everyone is probably aware that in order to strengthen the right-wing bloc, because obviously Israeli parties, in order to actually create a government, need to cobble together a coalition of a bunch of different parties that has at least 61 voices, but preferably more than that. If you're 61, you're obviously very, very vulnerable at any given vote of no confidence for one person not to side with their party or for something to happen. So people try to get in the high 60s, low 70s if they possibly can, and no party ever comes close to that. Even Bibi, who's leading right now in the polls, is only polling at 30 seats, which means that he has to get more than that amount from other parties. And Bibi therefore fully recognizes that he needs not only to do well for the Likud, he needs the right-wing bloc to do well. And in order to do that, he essentially tried to give some sort of certificate of kashrut to a very, very right-wing party called Otzma Yehudit, which is run by people who openly declare that they are descendants of Meir Kahana, who was a right-wing, considered by many, not all, but many people to have been a racist. And in fact, Kahana's party back in the day was ruled by the Supreme Court as to be ineligible to run because he was considered, they thought, to be a racist party, and racist parties can be outlawed by the Supreme Court. In this particular case, their party was not ruled out of bounds, but Michael Ben-Ari, who was the party head, it was the Supreme Court ruled that he could not run. Now, obviously, by the way, it's another issue which we can't discuss now, but the Supreme Court ruling that certain parties can't run is a very, very complicated issue for a democracy. People have to declare themselves both Jewish and democratic, and many people would argue that some of Israel's Arab parties, for example, are really not committed to Israel being a Jewish state, and therefore they ask themselves, why is a Jewish party on the far right rendered invalid when a party on the far left, which is an Arab party, so far has never been rendered invalid or unable to run? That's a whole other conversation, but there is a charge of racism, and I think many people on the call are aware that when Bibi, it was clearly Bibi's doing, when Otzma Yehudit cozied up to Bennett's party, therefore bringing them into the bloc, organizations such as AIPAC, which have been uniformly supportive of Israeli prime ministers, regardless of who they are, but who are perceived to have a very close relationship with Bibi Netanyahu, AIPAC publicly chastised him. That J Street did was not a surprise. That the Reform Rabbis of America chastised him was not a surprise. But that the American Jewish Committee did was surprising, and that AIPAC did was very surprising. In the eyes of many people, including many Israelis, he crossed a line there that simply cannot be crossed in a democracy. And that's one of the three main reasons that many people think it's time for a change. They just don't want a prime minister who's so openly willing to create deals subject to a charge of racism. A second issue, which actually predates the racism issue, is the longstanding issue of Bibi and corruption. Now, we're not going to go into what the four major cases of him are, against him are. They are cases 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, and 4,000. All that I think needs to be pointed out at this point is that there is some indication that these charges are going to be made. He's going to be indicted. And there's a fairly decent chance that some of these charges are going to stick and that he probably is going to get convicted on some of them. The charges in the 1,000 cases, basically taking cigars and champagne and jewelry for his wife, not entirely clear, by the way, in exchange for what. And Israelis pretty much are willing to look the other way. Their attitude is, you know what, if that's the way the world works, that's the way the world works. And they're really not terribly bent out of shape about it. But the other three charges, each of them in their own way, are in some ways not only about corruption, but are about the undermining of democracy in some way, and particularly undermining the freedom of the press. So case 2000 or file number 2000 is a deal where basically, strangely enough, even though Yisrael Hayom is the newspaper that Sheldon Adelson funds basically to be a mouthpiece for Bibi, for reasons that are not clear at all, Bibi was trying to make a deal with Yedioth Ahronot, which used to be Israel's best-selling daily, to give it it would give Bibi better coverage, and then Bibi would try to pass laws which would limit somehow the ability of Yisrael Hayom to get the kind of circulation that it's gotten. Why Bibi would want to undermine the own newspaper that Sheldon Adelson is paying for has never been made clear to anybody. A lot of people really don't think we understand the full case there. But to whatever extent Bibi is trying to exchange better coverage in a newspaper for legislation of any sort is obviously problematic. File 3000 is the very famous file, still the one that's least understood because so much of it is considered top secret, but about Israel's purchase of three submarines from the Germans, submarines which certain very high-ranking members of the military, including Bogi Yaalon at the meeting that I was at 2 days ago, he's obviously hardly an objective observer at this point, but still, say that Israel simply did not need, Israel does not need three more very high-tech submarines. And the fact that Netanyahu is alleged in some way, shape, manner, or form to have made a personal profit through all kinds of third-party things by buying submarines, which have obviously cost billions of dollars, if Israel didn't need them, is considered to be a mixing of personal interest and national security, which makes people very, very uncomfortable. And file 4000 is, again, has something to do with Bibi's getting better coverage in a news network, this one an online network called Walla, in exchange for legislation that would have actually favored the telephone company Bezek, and Bezek owns Walla. So there's, again, a kind of a complicated arrangement there. So those are all three of the issues of corruption. And in the eyes of many people, and this is what really Blue and White focused on when they presented themselves as a party, was that the corruption is too obvious. It is too wall-to-wall carpeting for it to be in any possible way healthy for a democracy. And they said all of Bibi's very legitimate accomplishments, notwithstanding, the racism and the corruption are reasons for him to go. The third area that they mentioned, and they started mentioning it later in their campaign than they did earlier, largely because he started to attack them in this way, is that Bibi is also kind of running an attack on democracy. Again, I want to reiterate, this is not, I'm not representing my own views here. I may agree, I may disagree. That's not the point. But this is the basic claim of the Blue and White Party, which is polling, by the way, even now that Bibi has taken the lead, is only polling three seats behind him. In other words, as of this morning's poll, Bibi was polling at 30 seats. They were polling at 27. So they're still doing fairly decently in the public sphere. So how has he attacked the democracy? So they would argue, of course, that he has created a kind of a boogeyman out of the left, arguing that people, the left in Israel doesn't exist. I think everybody understands that. But the hard left, the way that it existed prior to 2000, really doesn't exist anymore. The notion that the left was going to exchange land for peace was completely destroyed by what happened between 2000 and 2004 during the Second Intifada, when obviously Israel had offered in some way, shape, manner, or form a significant amount of land. What exactly was offered is still contended. But people like Dennis Ross, for example, say that it was a very generous offer and say that Arafat was simply unwilling to take it. And at that point, the whole idea of land for peace basically died. So to say that people are now leftists is a kind of a war battle cry, but it's not a real accusation. But Bibi's been going around saying, oh, Bibi, oh, TB. You're either going to get Bibi or you're going to get TB, which is a reference to Ahmed TB, who's one of the longest serving Arab MKs. The argument being, if I'm not prime minister, the Arabs are going to take over. That's ridiculous, but it's clever, and it is actually probably stuck a little bit. In 2013, Bibi parted ways with two of the people who were the last holdouts from Menachem Begin's government. One of them was Benny Begin, his son, who was not in the government but was a close associate, and Dan Meridor, who was in the government. They were considered to be kind of pillars of the old Likud. He got rid of them in 2013, and by the time that the elections of 2015 came around, it was pretty clear that there was a sense that Bibi was already assailing democracy. Now, we don't have time to go into all of these in detail, but I'll just list a couple of things that the party, Blue and White, particularly lists commonly when they want to talk about his assault on democracy. Ayelet Shaked, who's the Minister of Justice, is fairly hard right and is trying to, she says that what she's trying to do is undo Aharon Barak's very activist court. What people would say that she's doing who don't agree with her is that she's actually undermining the legitimacy of the judicial system itself. It's not unlike, by the way, some of the conversation that's been taking place in the United States about Trump's relationship with the judiciary, even though it's not analogous in any way near 100%. But there are people who say that there's an attack on the judiciary in general and the Supreme Court specifically. Then there was the very famous case of Elor Azaria, this Israeli soldier who shot a Palestinian who was already lying on the ground in Hebron and who later said out loud that he shot him because he deserved it. The chief of staff immediately came out and castigated Azaria, but the right wing actually pushed back at the chief of staff. And in what Blue and White claims was a violation of all legitimate tenets of a democracy, Bibi backed the family of the soldier and did not back the chief of staff. And as Bogi Yaalon put it 2 nights ago at this meeting that I was at, he said at the point when the Jewish state is basically willing to see its prime minister defend a soldier who shot a completely neutralized Arab lying on the ground in cold blood, obviously killing him, he shot him in the head. He said at that point, this country's become something, said Bogi Yaalon, which is not the country that I was raised in. Not everybody would put it quite that strongly, but there is a sense that Bibi has gotten involved in right-wing issues more than he should have. He's sort of unleashed a huge attack on the recently departed police commissioner, Roni Alshech, calling him a leftist. Roni Alshech is by no means a leftist. He may be a centrist. And Bibi has done the same thing with Avihai Mandelblit, who's the attorney general, who decided to actually indicate prior to the elections that Bibi was going to be indicted. So we're not going to be able to go into all of that in detail. There's also all kinds of issues about the way in which Bibi is conducting the elections. A lot of us in Israel have been getting innumerable texts on our phones, all kinds of things from right-wing parties, from numbers that we don't recognize. It's widely assumed that those are coming from people behind the Likud. And in fact, this morning, the Board of Elections argued that that has to actually be investigated as a potentially criminal issue. The accusations against Benny Gantz that he's weak, that he's actually clinically insane, not as a kind of a metaphor, but clinically insane, that he's had a stroke, that he was doing something illegal or shady in his cybersecurity company, or that he himself is responsible for being careless with the security of his phone. All of those people think are kind of ad hominem attacks that are groundless and baseless, and therefore there's a sense that it's time to move on. The one last thing about Bibi that I want to say before just talking very quickly about some takeaways is that I think that one thing that doesn't get mentioned enough is that after 10 years of Bibi's prime ministership, I think there's very few Israelis who could tell you what Bibi would do if he controlled all 120 seats in the Knesset. What would be his social vision? What would be his attitude to the relationship between religion and state? What would he actually do about the West Bank and Gaza? What would he really like to do, setting aside what he can do? I think there's really very few Israelis who can answer that question with any degree of certainty. And I would just say this is the only part that I'll say is my own personal opinion, that I think is a failure of leadership and a failure of vision for us not to know what he's really all about. Why is he going to win? Why is it likely that he's going to win? Because of all of the accomplishments that he generally has, because Blue and White, I think, has failed to articulate very clearly a platform which is very different from his, because the more we've gotten into the campaign, people realize they don't really know who Benny Gantz is, and some of the negative campaigning and some of the negative advertising has stuck. So that's one reason that he's going to win. And I'll just mention, of course, that this morning's coup, so to speak, of getting back the body of a deceased Israeli soldier, Zacharia Baumol, who's been missing in action for 37 years, it's impossible to overstress the degree to which that is a huge issue in Israel. The timing is obviously striking, let's just use that word. But again, apparently Putin was involved in getting this body back. Israelis can name the other missing soldiers in a way that very few Americans can name the names of Americans missing in action. It's a huge issue in Israel. It's a huge coup for Bibi exactly 5 days before the election. It's inconceivable that that is not going to help him in the polls. And it's, of course, wonderful for Baumol's family that they'll be able to bury him, which I believe they're doing later today, or happened earlier today, I'm not quite certain. But they certainly deserve that peace of mind, but it's obviously going to help Bibi. 2 minutes about takeaways. Number one, there is an Israeli center. Even if Blue and White does not win, what we saw happen when Blue and White declared its candidacy was that there is a center, which is a very good thing, regardless of how this plays out. Number two, I think that real damage has been done to the democratic apparatus here. 27% of Israelis polled by the Israel Democracy Institute say they do not trust the integrity of the outcome of the vote. Now, that's a huge number, 27%, and there's reason to be concerned about that. 52% believe that Bibi is lying about the submarine issue. So 52% of the people in the country believe that he's lying about the submarine issue, but he still manages to win. It tells you something about where Israelis are holding on the issue of honesty and transparency and elections. And in fact, this morning, David Levy, who is a former politician, no longer really involved in politics, formerly of Likud, a minister, came out and said, I couldn't find it on the English press, but it's all over the Hebrew press today. He said, "Hakol mitpare mitmotet leneged einenu." Everything is literally falling apart at the seams right in front of our eyes. He said, if a kind of a foreign, an alien came and looked at this society, he said, they would think that it's a society that's trying to commit suicide. That's too strong. But there are very, very serious warning signs of something going on in this society. Last two sentences. What are we missing in this election? We are certainly missing a kind of decency and morality and a certain way of speaking. And we are missing a Jewish vision. The only people that are putting out a vision of how this country should be Jewish are the far right. Bibi says nothing about it. Blue and White says nothing about it. Bogi Alom the other night was talking about a country that needs to be Jewish because it has to be moral and just. Well, any Protestant minister would say the same thing. And I would just simply say that one of the things we're trying to do with the college is to create a civility of discourse and a seriousness of conversation about the Jewishness of what this country should be in a way that I think and I hope that 20 years from now, as Israel goes to the elections again, we'll be able to see that our students and our graduates have had some impact on the society, which is now very much under the microscope. So I'll stop there.